You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. And welcome back to episode 8 of Talk the Walk. My guest today is Lynn Whitford. I first met Lynn back in 2010 when I was working out in northeast Arnhem Land supporting Gove Crisis Accommodation as a children's counsellor. As you do when you arrive in a new place, you tend to seek out potential colleagues to work with, especially as I was on a fly-in, fly-out arrangement and we had stayed connected ever since. Lynn has a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology Sociology, a Master's in Human Ecology Family Studies, and a Master's in Educational Counselling Psychology from the University of Alberta in Canada. Lynn is a Cree Métis woman from Canada. Lynn first came to Australia in the early 70s and has come and gone on a few occasions for extended periods of time. Became an Australian citizen in 1976, and she tells me she is a dual citizen. For the last 9 years, Lynn's been working as a social worker at the Gove District Hospital at Nhulunbuy in the Northern Territory. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today, Lynn.
Oh, I really look forward to it.
Great. I'm just wondering, because I know that there's a lot to your history, if you could outline, I guess, how you came to be working with Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory, because I know that you've come and gone a bit from Gove in particular, but what brought you here to Australia and how did you come to be working in that community?
I actually came out to both Australia and New Zealand because of a Time article I read. I had just broken an engagement and was looking for a new challenge. And the Time magazine wrote about all the jobs that were available in New Zealand and Australia, and I thought, well, why not? So I actually worked in a resort in the mountains in Canada, and then I took a ship, and I went through Honolulu and Fiji. I got to New Zealand. I got off in New Zealand. I was there about 7 or 8 months, and I thought it was a great place to be. But you had to actually, you could only stay the amount of time that you specified when you got off the ship. So I had to get on the ship at a certain time. Hmm. And I'd already made arrangements to work in Tassie. So I worked in Tassie. Mm. And then I went to Melbourne. And I went up the coast hitchhiking. Mm. All the way to Cairns. And you know what? There was no work in Cairns. So it was November. So we came back and we hitchhiked in over the road, and we all had jobs. There was about 4 of us traveling together, and we all had jobs within about half an hour. So I stayed in Darwin for a while, but as you know, Darwin's always been expensive to mm-hmm. live in. So one of the guys in the pub said, well, why don't you go to Gove? If you work for them, they provide accommodation and meals and all kinds of things. So that's actually how I got here, and I really liked it here. I felt very much at home here. It was a laid-back way of living, and it really intrigued me. And I ended up meeting my husband here, and it was him and I that trekked back and forth from Canada to Australia and Australia to Canada. And really, I've spent more of my life here than I have any place else.
Mm. You said you felt at home here in the Northern Territory. I was wondering, what is it that helped you connect to this place? Is it something about your own history?
Well, the thing is, when I say that I'm a Métis Cree woman or a Cree Métis woman, in Canada we've got 3 different ways that you can be identified as an Aboriginal person. One is as a Treaty Indian, one is as a Métis, and that word literally means half-breed, and the other group is Inuit, and that refers to the people that live up north in the snow. Mm. And not to say that the rest of us don't live in snow in Canada, but you know, they live very far north. So if you're one of those groups, then you are identified as an Aboriginal person. And of course, there was a lot of conflict in Canada, just as there has been throughout the history of Australia, about how acceptable you are as a Native person or as an Aboriginal person. how you're identified, the rights that are accorded or not accorded to you. And of course, the treaties in Canada, I lived in the Treaty 6 area, and my grandmother actually was a Native woman, and we use the words Native and Aboriginal pretty well interchangeably. She lived kind of where some of the first settlements were and some of the first forts were, and we're actually close to where they signed some of these treaties. And her family decided that because it was getting very overcrowded there, that they would come through, and the rivers were used as a means of travel. So they came to where I actually grew up, just outside a place called Edmonton. And there was, that land was pretty open and available for settlement. And so I had mixed blood ancestry. So it was interesting. People, when I grew up, I was told that I could, you know, in brackets, pass. So I shouldn't mention my Aboriginal heritage. So, of course, when you'd say that to me, then I want to mention it. Do you know what I'm saying? That when someone tells you you can't do something, you want to do it. So to be honest, when I went to university, I focused all my schoolwork around Aboriginal issues. So when I would have to write something in psychology, I would use the Aboriginal population. And for me, that was very much a learning, because I hadn't known much, and I didn't actually, like, it wasn't like I could go to my family and get my history from them, because they weren't comfortable to talk about it.
Oh, right. So what was daily life like for you living in the Treaty 6 area?
Well, the thing is, we did a lot of things. Actually, one of the most valuable things about me working in East Arnhem is that I regularly went out and visited communities at that time. And I think really being involved with the women in the communities, I was supposed to be setting up a DV house. And I spent most of my time in Remangining, but the women and I used to go out hunting and fishing and do all those things. And the thing that I think struck me more than anything, how those women worked together, really reminded me of how my mom and her sisters worked together. You know, it was harvest time. They all pitched in and did everything. So I could really see all those similarities. And it was quite interesting, because when I did decide that I was going to go back to Canada for a while, I remember those women again in Remangining saying to me, "Why are you going back to Canada?" And I said, "Because I know your people better than I understand my own, and I think I need to get some of that learning." So when I came back to Canada, it was just like the doors opened for me to kind of find out what my traditions were, where I'd come from, who I was related to. And these things, it was just like it was a sliding slope. First I did this, and then I did that. I went to university. I finished my degree because I had 3 years and I needed four because they'd upgraded it. And then one of the profs said to me, "Well, why don't you go to graduate school?" Me? Because it had never been something that I ever really thought about, you know. But I really, really liked learning. And even at that stage, I was doing things, you know, using my people as the participants in any kind of research studies I did. And I remember that I really wanted to go. I went and I did my human ecology first, because that was easier to get into as a graduate student. But I really wanted to be in psychology. And it was really competitive. I think they had seven places. The year that I applied, they had seven places and 200 people applied.
Wow.
And so one of my profs suggested to me, because I'd already done 1 year in psychology, but not in counseling. I'd done it in the basic stream. So she said to me, "You know what I think you should do?" She said, "I think you should go out and see if you can't get some references from some of the elders that you know." And she said, "I think that'll clean your spot." Another one of the profs, who was the person who was receiving all the applications, she saw me and she just gave me the biggest grin, and she said, "Well, I look forward to receiving more and more elder information." Because in the end, I put 10 elders in and talked about them and said where they were from and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it did get me in there. So that was really good for me, and I felt really good about it. So, of course, all this time, too, I'm participating in the Aboriginal community, because there's more events available. There's powwows, there's round dances, there's get-togethers, there's information talks. So I was kind of just eating up this knowledge, and I ended up getting a job in the summer working in a Native halfway house. And one of the things that I did is I attended a Native life skills program, and they wanted me to evaluate it. So I was doing some of that, but of course it's hard because you're a participant as well, you know. So what I ended up doing is when I went back to university and when I was in graduate studies in human ecology, I used that Native life skills program as my thesis. I mean, it was wonderful because I had participated in it and had the experience of, you know, getting to know the elder in charge of the program and all the other people that made the program work. And then I got to write about it, you know. So it was really, I mean, it was really special. And I felt really intimidated about it. But then on the other hand, I think because the experience itself had meant so much that I just found a way to write about it, you know.
How have those learnings and those writings that you did around that time, how has it informed kind of the development of your practice today?
Well, the thing is, I also worked in another Native organization where I worked in foster care. And what I did is I interviewed people who wanted to be foster carers. And so in that Aboriginal organization, you had to be an Aboriginal person in order to qualify to be a foster carer.
Yes.
So I interviewed them like as a couple, but I also did training. So I really learned a lot there. And I mean, to me, it was just like widening my circle, you know. And I really enjoyed doing that work. And I realized how much I really like to work with families. And what I did eventually, actually, is I started working at a women's shelter in Canada. And, you know, as much as there were times that it just felt like your heart was breaking, it was really nice because you would sit down and you would have dinner with them. And so you develop a different kind of a relationship with people who really, some of them were not closely related to me, but there were lots of people who were, you know, related to the same people that I was related to and had been in similar situations that I'd been in. And so I think it just felt really comfortable for me. And like I said, I really enjoyed it. I didn't see it as kind of going to work. And, you know, as I said, it was hard sometimes with the kids because the kids were just so innocent and so blasé about things that, you know, are really hard parts of domestic violence. But, you know, I remember a child telling me that he'd say to his mom, "Mom, remember the time that we were in bed and Daddy had that gun?" And of course, you could just see her. She was just cringing because she didn't want to hear it. And she was really uncomfortable with it. And for him, the little boy, he was trying to find a way to kind of normalize it and to be able to come to terms with it. And so he was doing it by talking about it.
Yes.
Which he felt was a safe place. And she was doing it by trying to pretend it had never happened. So it's really difficult for both of them. And of course, she'd come to the shelter a couple of times, you know, with kind of big periods in between. And, you know, really, I probably saw her three different times over about a 5-year period. And really, probably after 4 years or so, she was getting better at kind of dealing with it. But you know, those things are really traumatic things. And, and you know, it's interesting when you become a counselor because they try and teach you all these different ways that you're supposed to interact with people or engage with people. And I found that as a result of my thesis, for example, like in my thesis, what I did is the process of meeting another Native person and how you gradually, like, first of all, you introduce yourself, they introduce themselves, and then you start talking about where you're from, and they tell you where you tell them, they tell you, and then you say, "Oh, do you know so-and-so?" Or, "I knew someone that..." And so basically what you're doing is you're trying to establish connection. And of course, with Aboriginal people in Australia, that's very much what it's all about. It's all about relationship. And I think sometimes it's so simple, like it sounds simple, right? And I think that often it gets missed, the kind of gist of what it is to kind of feel valued and accepted in an Aboriginal community even though you're not from their clan or their tribe, it's all about relationship. You know, you're building something, you know, you're relating to each other, and, you know, really you wait for them to give you the signals of what's appropriate and what's not, and, you know, how you can,
right,
you know, develop a relationship.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, is that harder with your own people back in Canada than it is here in Australia, or is it easier?
Well,
because
easier,
you're part
actually.
Of that community. Okay.
Well, not just that, but the thing is, you know, I live in Gove and I work with Yolngu people, and a lot of Yolngu people don't speak much English.
Mm.
So that makes a lot of difference. You know, when you're trying to have that exchange,
yes.
Because a lot of times, you know, you have to look to nonverbal signals, you know, to establish those things. Like, you know, that somebody was dying the other day, and I don't say that. I mean, I say it casually, but I don't mean it casually. And the thing is, I just felt like it was a woman, and there was a number of people in the room with her, and I checked on them regularly, but I just felt, you know, I knew who she was. I didn't know her really well. And I know that I was accepted if I went and sat in the room.
Mm.
But I felt like she was being cared for. So I was checking on her through the day. And, you know, the women would look up and, you know, kind of almost wave at me, you know. And I'd think, well, you know, they're handling it, you know. And
yeah.
I had said to them earlier, if they wanted me for anything, I was available, you know. And you do those things, but with your own people, the thing is, like, I know where all those places are. Like, who knew where Nooka was? I didn't, you know? And just getting used to the geography and all those things. And the fact, actually, that my grandmother had traveled, you know, like a really kind of almost like a settler's route, although it was on the water, right? It was along the rivers, you know, that they traveled. So because you listen to your family talk about things that they feel safe enough to talk about,
yes.
You know, so you do. So I think that's what the difference is, you know. And the thing is, you know, your own people always do something a little bit differently. Like, I was thinking about that today. One of the things that we do in our culture is it's really common for Native women to wear bead earrings. It's a very common thing. So that when you go out in the general public, and you see someone with beaded earrings, you think, ah, she's probably Native, right?
Right.
Or, you know, a certain style, like a certain Aztec print, you know, is seen as Native, you know. Having a blanket that's been woven, the Pendleton blankets, for example, you know, like they're very expensive and they're wool blankets, but they're seen as something Native, you know. The kind of men's shirts that have got the fringes on them, and again, so... Sometimes people identify and they don't. Like when I look at the women here with their long skirts, I mean, older women always, I have never in my life seen a person that lives locally wear pants, slacks.
No, that's,
you know,
right.
Jeans, yep. Nothing, you know, and, you know, and the girls up until they're what, 14 or 15, they sometimes wear like long shorts, like long sport shorts. They never were, up until recently, of course. Some of the teenagers do, you know, when they're late teens. But it's very interesting how dress, you know, makes a difference and signals certain things. And in some cases, it doesn't signal anything.
So it sounds like there's a lot of similarities between, you know, your own people back in Canada and what you've experienced here in Australia compared to someone like myself who's typical white Western European. And I was just wondering, how helpful or unhelpful is that when you're coming from Canada to Australia and you're working with, you know, Australian Aboriginal people?
Well, I think it's really interesting because quite often I take women down, like women who've had babies, I take women down to register them at Centrelink. And I find the car a great place to talk because it's, you know, they're a captive audience, you're a captive audience. And it isn't threatening, and it, you know, it's not usually very long. And so I'll say to them, I'm an Aboriginal woman from Canada, and they'll say, oh, you know. So, I mean, they make a positive response. I've never, ever had a negative response when I've said something like that. And sometimes then I'll talk a little bit about, you know, how many kids they have, and, you know, do they have, you know. And I'm very encouraging, actually, especially as far as the girls are concerned, and saying, gee, it's, you know, I hope you have good things with your daughter, and I hope she learns lots and stays in school, and maybe she can, because, you know, some of them are health workers and some of them are do different things that are really important in the community. And I say, I hope she follows your footsteps, or, you know, gee, it looks like some of them are really, really supportive of their daughters, you know, and I try and emphasize that. I don't, the thing is, it's kind of, that's the thing that's quite different though here, is that it's very much a women to women conversation.
Okay.
Like as an Aboriginal woman, you don't really talk to men that much.
Mm.
You know, your social circle is the women.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think is really interesting for me is probably in about the last 2 or 3 years, I've noticed, because when I see somebody, I say hello, and I know that sometimes that's not a common thing around the hospital. People don't necessarily say hello to the patients, but I mean, I do because that's who I am. So I've noticed lately, like in the last 2 or 3 years, that men will say hello to me, and they will do it first. And the first time that happened, I kind of went, you know, because it's not usual.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what it means really is that, first of all, that I'm not a young, you know, I'm an older woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they don't feel threatened. And the thing is, they've seen me around so much that I'm just like part of the woodwork, you know. That's really a good thing, right?
And possibly see you as an elder?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but, you know, see me as somebody who, like, because I take care of, like, little things. Do you know what I mean? Like I take somebody to Centrelink, I take them to the bank, I help them if, you know, if they want to talk about their kids or if there's money issues or, you know, just things like, I do all kinds of things for them. And I think that they know that they can come to me and ask me to do things. See, one of the things that I think is very difficult to get done if you're an Aboriginal person, is to apply for a birth certificate, to apply for various things like that. And I'll mention it just now that about 3 or 4 days ago, they've decided that birth certificates and, what are they called, 18 plus cards?
Yes.
It's free to apply for them at the moment.
Yes.
Which is huge. I don't know if you know that, Lucy.
Yeah,
but that's a really big deal.
We've got the banned drinking register being reintroduced by the Northern Territory government, and that's brought this on, this decision to give out free birth certificates so people can prove who they are when they go into a liquor outlet.
And it's excellent because in Canada, when you're born, you get given a birth certificate, but you don't hear. So people don't have a birth certificate. And lots of times what's confusing as well is with the Yolngu women here, they have to name their child in order to get the birth money. But what they name them, they don't know what that child's name is going to be because it's actually, they don't get named until they go home, to their communities. So it's a different name. So in some ways it's good. So this way, you know, with them being free at the moment, like I'm telling everybody, make sure you get your birth certificate in, you know, because it costs from Gove to get your birth certificate in Darwin, it's $56. That's a lot of money. And then, of course, if you want to get your 18-plus card, that's money as well. But you can't get an 18-plus card if you don't have a birth certificate. So I know that's one thing that I would say is a real problem for Aboriginal people who are used to living on the land, who are used to just, you know, not carrying any kind of form of identification on them, that's really difficult in many ways.
Right. Can you speak about some of the ways how it complicates their lives?
Oh, I think so. I mean, there's a woman who, she's probably about the same age that I am, and she wants to travel. She's tried twice to get her passport, and she can't get it because she has different information that calls her a different name, different stages. And of course, some of the people that could have verified that have already died. So it's a real problem for her. Of course, you can't go overseas unless you get a passport. So it's a real complicating factor. And I know of somebody who is registered with Centrelink, and he has seven different names. Seven different teams. I mean, it just complicates things.
That must be a nightmare, really, trying to work through the systems.
You know, well, it is. And then after you get it, where do you keep it to make sure it's safe? I mean, there are all these complications, and I think lots of time, as people that have grown up in a Western world, they don't realize how difficult it is for Aboriginal people going to school, register. And lots of times, if you ask people, they honestly don't know when they're born. They don't.
Mm.
Some of them might know the year, but they wouldn't know the date. You know, so there's all kinds of things like that. And I know getting on a plane, for example, the two things that you need is you need identification, but you also need shoes.
Right.
So if you go to get on a plane to get out of here, you know, I've had to go back a number of times for people to their houses and get them some thongs or whatever because they wouldn't let them on the plane.
Yeah, I'm starting to get a bit of a picture of what a typical day might look like for you working in a very busy hospital in a remote area of Australia. Can you give us, for those listening that don't have any idea what this might look like, can you give us a bit of an idea of what your day would look like in the hospital there? What sort of things are you doing from morning to night?
Okay, so when I come in, we usually have a handover, which is the patients that are in the hospital and when they got here and if there's any special issues. And then they usually say to me, oh, this person, they need to go to the dentist. Can you take them to the dentist? Or this person wants to talk about, or may not want to talk about, but they want them to talk to me about their DV incident. So mm-hmm. It's just a real big range of things. The other thing is we have a long-term patient here, and this is not supposed to be a hospital that has long-term patients, but it sometimes happens. I mean, he's really hungry to get things to read. So I've actually used my own library card, and I try and get him something every week. Like last week I got him the Guinness Book of Records, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I asked him what he wanted this week, and he said, I want a dictionary. And I'm thinking, how am I going to manage that? You know what I mean? Because he just wants knowledge, because he's confined to a bed.
Wow.
And he can't get up, and he can't move around. And those are the things that interest him. And, you know, the thing is, I don't regularly go to town, but sometimes I do, and I pick him up a paper. And actually, there was some NLC news that I'm going to actually go into the NLC office here and see if they, when they get something in, they can bring it up so he can read it. Because he just wants, he must be bored to tears.
Mm.
Well, he obviously must be bored to tears, right?
Mm.
If he wants to read a dictionary, I'd say he'd definitely be bored. But so the kinds of things, you just don't know what people are going to ask you. And, you know, sometimes they need to go and visit somebody, or somebody's going on a plane and they didn't realize they were going on a plane. So then I have to take them home to their house to pick mm-hmm. up their clothes, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's really difficult. That's one of the things I noticed when I used to go out to communities a lot more. People were given very little notice about having to come to the hospital. So mm-hmm. they come to the hospital, they've got no toiletries, they've got no change of clothes.
Mm.
Really, I mean, they were just rushed off into the plane, and that makes it so hard.
Mm.
You know, I think we take for granted lots of times that when we go to the hospital, we have as much time as we need to get ready, and that often doesn't happen for our patients.
Right. I was just wondering, can you give us a bit of an idea on the area that the Gove Hospital services and how many communities that covers?
Yeah. Well, actually, most of the people that come in here are from the same language group. They're from the Ulnumatha group, and there's about seven communities. But those are places that are like established communities. In addition to that, Yirrkala, which is only 20 minutes from where Gove is, they actually have the nicest beach, believe me. They have outstations. Now, the outstations are more like, I guess if you wanted to go and have a cabin on a lake, that kind of thing. So they have very few facilities there. They have housing, and they have a couple of families that live there. They might have an extra house that they use when medical staff fly in, and that's what they use for the day for their clinic. They might also have schooling and a building that they use for schooling. But other than that, they pretty well have most times they have no store. So, you know, unless you go out and come to a central place like Gove, you can't just decide you're just going to go down the street and have an ice cream because there's no place to have an ice cream. You know,
yeah, that's
just,
right.
Just aren't any extras at all. So it's quite different in that point of view. But that's the Homelands Movement. That's as a result of the Homelands Movement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people prefer to be out on the homelands because they find they can control their kids easier and that they can settle them down more so that they get to school and that it's more peaceful out there.
Yeah.
One of the reasons they don't like coming to Gove or Nhulunbuy is the fact that we have alcohol here. We've got a private club. We've got a hotel. And there's drinking. And there's access to drugs is a lot easier. It's got its problems, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it's servicing a big area.
A huge area. And I don't know if you know where it is, but with the Gulf of Carpentaria, there's a Queensland side and there's an NT side. And it's a big U-shaped body of water. And the top of the U that's in the west, that's exactly where Gove or Nhulunbuy is. Gove is the airport, actually, and Nhulunbuy is the town. It was named after, they call it Nhulunbuy because it was called Nhulun the Hill, because there's a great big huge hill here. And that's why they called it what they did.
And like, can you describe how many patients in the hospital will be Aboriginal? What percentage do you know?
Over 90%. Between 90 and 95%. And the thing that's difficult is that most of them don't speak English. Or if they do, they only speak a little bit of English. And I think the thing that's really, you know, Aboriginal people, one of the things about them is they are really good at, what should I say, watching others and see what they do. Mm. And so that when you're having a conversation with them, whether you're counseling them, you don't really counsel them because it's not a formal kind of a thing. It's a more relaxed kind of way of, you know, relating to them.
Yes.
But the thing that's really interesting is they're very good at assessing what they think you want to hear.
Yes.
And often that's what they do is they tell you. And, you know, I mean, seriously, it's taken me a really long time to pick that up because they are so good at it.
Yeah.
So they make you think that they know what you're talking about. So you, they fool the doctors and the nurses all the time.
Mm.
Oh no, he knew exactly what I was talking about. But you see, they're very good at, they see how we put our faces when we understand something. And so they do the same. So you think, they've got it.
What are the implications of that for their treatment? Can things go wrong because, you think a patient has understood something and they haven't?
Absolutely huge. Absolutely huge. And it's really interesting because we have 35 beds, but most of the patients that come here, they're prepared to do any kind of treatment that's available in Gove. But by and large, they're not prepared to go to hospital in Darwin. They don't like Darwin. They don't feel comfortable in Darwin. And like it's leaving country. So as a rule, they don't want to go. And sometimes doctors, you know, work really hard to talk them into going.
Mm.
You know, but it's interesting that most people, if they feel like they've got something that's life-threatening, or even if they don't, they don't want to go to Darwin.
Yeah. Is that because lots of people come to Darwin for treatment and they just don't come home for whatever reason, whether they pass away or they get too ill or...
That would be it. But I think the other thing is too, like if I was a mother, I wouldn't want my teenage child going to Darwin, because that's the other thing too, is sometimes they don't come back. They spend the money that, because, you know, it's like all, we go to Darwin, we think it's a big treat. You know, we want to spend our money by new clothes, go to movies, go out for the night, go for dinner, and then we have no money left. Well, you know, we're in the Western world accustomed enough to using money that we have other sources of money, and lots of times they don't, so they don't get back.
Mm.
So they long grass it, and, you know, their life changes. And, you know, lots of people, they're really, the kinship system here is really strong.
Right.
And everybody knows, like kids know from the time they're 2 years old where they fit in the pegboard of life, so to speak, you know, who you're related to. And one of the really things that I think makes you know people feel really secure is the fact that that never changes throughout their lives. That the relationships that they have with other family members, they stay the same. Mm. And even when you get married, if for some reason that you don't remain with that partner, the child born of that marriage or relationship, he still has the same relationship to the people that he did when you were together. So I think that's a really nice thing. Like I said, yeah, all those relationships, it's like they're forever.
Yeah, it's a wonderful system.
I think so. Mm. I think so. And I think that makes a lot of difference to people. And so even people who have been away, who have been in Darwin, say, for example, for 20 years, when they come home, like, no one says to them, where have you been? What's wrong? You know what I mean? I've never seen anybody kind of rat them out about it, you know? You just say, oh, good to see you, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that makes a lot of difference. And people do want to come home to die. They do. They want to be here.
Mm.
And even though they may not say that, there was a fellow who came back, I guess, about 6 months ago. And I guess he went on and on and on. He was in a rehabilitation area. And I want to go home and blah, 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 blah. Mm. And, you know, when he got home, and of course, I don't think either he was very cooperative with letting them kind of treat him. So I don't think they had a complete picture of how sick he really was. Mm-hmm. But when he got here, he was probably only here a month and he passed on. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I know that he wanted to be here.
Yeah, he was in the right place.
Yeah, exactly.
So exactly. I'd love to delve into the area of struggles and challenges with you. What have been the most difficult challenges for you in the work?
Well, I think it's really interesting that I'm quite verbal about saying to people, aren't I, Lucy, that I'm an Aboriginal Canadian, right? And I think for my colleagues, like the doctors and the nurses, they don't really know what that means. And I don't think they really, I mean, I'm just thinking this as I speak, believe me, that they don't know how to ask me anything about it, right? Because of my schooling and because of my experience and because I always knew in my heart that I was an Aboriginal person anyway, well, I may not have identified it in such a specific way, but I knew that there was something different about the way that I thought about things.
Mm-hmm.
I knew, because I actually used to really like social studies in school because we used to have all these debates about things. But I always came from a slightly different perspective. And I mean, I didn't kind of consciously do it. It was just the way I thought about things.
Mm.
And so I think that I've got like a very kind of multicultural perspective about things.
Mm-hmm.
And a really more open-ended way of thinking about things like living in a collective society or living in an individualistic society and that kind of thing. It just seems like it suits me. It just makes sense to me. But the thing is that it's hard to realize that because that comes so natural to me, it doesn't come natural to other people.
Yes.
They don't see more than one way of viewing the world. They have a worldview that says, this is the way we look at it and that's it. You know what I mean? So it's pretty hard sometimes, I think, for other people when I come out with certain things because they don't know how I got there.
Right. Are you talking the conversations you're having with other staff in the hospital, doctors, nurses, etc., and
That's
their view of the world being challenges. Very different?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because I think, like I said, they just don't understand it. And the thing is, too, I think that because I come from Canada and I speak a little bit different, you know, I'm really passionate about lots of things. And it probably comes across in my voice. And I think they probably think, how do I ask her this? And they think, oh, this is just work. What's the big deal? Who cares?
Can you share an example of something where it's been a real clash of ideas or?
Yeah. Well, I think, for example, this happened on the maternity ward. And there was a woman that had twins. And she said probably about 5 minutes after she had her twins, well, I'm not growing them both up. I'm only growing one. And, of course, you can see the looks on these midwives' faces. They're going, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because it's just not the way they think about it.
Yes.
And they said, well, how are we going to handle this? And I said, you know, so I knew a woman on that community. She was actually a woman that dealt with social worker type issues, although they weren't labeled strictly as such. Mm-hmm. You know, she was just a helpful person and knew how to get around other people and knew who to talk to. Because that's the thing on a community. There's always someone that you can go to and say, listen, I need help with so-and-so, or how do I talk to so-and-so, or, you know, if I want to deal with this issue, you know, they'll tell you, really.
Yes.
If they know you're sincere and wanting to know, they will help you out with those things anyway. So I just said, well, you know, why don't we phone the community? So we ended up phoning the community. And I had been out there, and I knew this woman, and she knew everybody. She knew everybody. She worked in the school, and she worked as a, I don't know, secretary, I guess. You know, the person that greets everybody, receptionist. I don't know what her position actually was. But so I called her, and I said, you know, what do you do? And she said, oh, she said, look, I'll mention it to the family. And she said, they'll get back to you. So they got back to us probably in about 10 or 15 minutes and said, oh, yeah, no problem. The twin one will stay with the mom, and twin two will go with so-and-so because she's really good with kids and she's feeling a bit clunky at the moment or whatever, right?
So this and was someone related to the mother? Someone in the community that was related to the mother, like a sister?
In her someone... Yeah, like in her extended family, right? Yeah, and that was just it. I mean, and they just went back and we told, you know, was one of those speaker conversations. She said, okay. I mean, it was just such a done deal. Like, it was easy.
Yeah.
You know? But I think it's accepting that other people hold different values for things, and it's not about being right or wrong. It's about what works in the situation, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's a really good example.
And like I said, the other thing is it happened so quickly. There was another time, and this happened fairly recently. For about the past couple of years, we've been having lots of women having babies that are, like, pretty young, like 14, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they come in and they just look like babies themselves. They're just beautiful girls. And they're not really good at talking about their experience of, you know, how they're feeling about having the baby. And it's not uncommon to have women who have experienced domestic violence throughout their pregnancy as well.
Right.
And I always think that it's a difficult subject to tackle at the best of times. And I don't think that, you know, that it's easy to talk to these women who are, they haven't had babies yet. They're here to have their babies, because that's the other thing too, that in this whole area, you must come in to the hospital to have your baby. You cannot have it in the clinic. Mm. I mean, it happens very rarely. Like, we probably had one this year and maybe one last year, but that's out of, 100 births? So it's not common to have it like that. And I don't usually ask a lot about the DV because I think it's a difficult thing to talk about at the best of times, right? So I just usually kind of, you know, mention it, and if they want to talk, and if we're in a situation, they might talk. But anyway, I did say something to this young girl because I thought, you know, maybe my instincts are wrong here. Maybe I should be asking more things, because we have what we call the family safety framework. And, you know, it's, they have all these tick boxes and they make it look like it's a really easy thing to talk about. Mm. And, you know, I don't feel like it is anyway. Mm. So I thought, okay. And she had a beautiful grandma. Like, her grandma was really understanding, really easy to get along with. And this young girl, she was just pouty and bad tempered, and she wouldn't even talk, never mind talk about DV. So anyway, so I decided I would try it. So I said a couple of things. I think I said about, maybe over a 10-minute period, I might have said 3 or 4 sentences, right? So anyway, she stomps out of the room. And meanwhile, her grandma, I think she was really tired. She wanted to go back to the community for a while because this child was taking a longer time to have her baby. She had been there 3 weeks, and it was going to be at least another 2 weeks because they had the dates wrong or something. So anyway, she'd gone back to the community. So she just stomped out of the room. And I got this phone call on my phone about 5 minutes later, and it was her grandmother. And her grandmother said to me, Lynn, she said, my granddaughter just phoned me and said, could you please not ask her those questions because it's really upsetting her. Mm. And I thought to myself, like, what a good way to do it, right? She didn't stomp and carry on and get all mad at me or anything like that. She just phoned her grandmother, and her grandmother called me and, you know, very gently said, you know, she really isn't comfortable with you asking her all those questions. And I said, fine. Wow. That was the end of the questions, right?
That's so, such a tricky thing to be working with, isn't
well, it?
Knowing that, you know, the unborn baby, the effects of domestic violence on that child, which can be ongoing for the life of the child as it grows into an adult. That's such a difficult position to be in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that's why sometimes I don't say things, because first of all, you know, it isn't even easy if you speak the same language. Because I work with, you know, other Indigenous liaison people, and some of them are okay to talk about, some of them aren't.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not that they're, you know, young women and they're being smart and chatty or anything like that. But I mean, it's a difficult area. It really is. And the other thing is, too, I think what's difficult about it as well is they have to come in here early. So they come in here at 36 weeks. That's 4 weeks till they're going to have their baby. That's,
wow.
You know, but they then, you know, there's all the discussion about, oh, well, you know, do we have the dates right? Do we have the dates wrong? So they come in here. They're bored like crazy. And they just want to go out of here. So then when they come in from the community right away, they'll often say, well, I'm not going back to him. But by the time they've been in here for 3 weeks, they'd go anywhere. Do you know what I mean? I'm not trying to make light of the situation, but I'm just saying they do change their minds. And of course, you know, absence does sometimes make the heart grow fonder. Like, he looks a lot better when you haven't seen him for 3 weeks and he's saying all these wonderful things to you on the phone, right? It's not easy. And, you know, the thing is, too, we've started to use a little bit. And you know, again, it depends on how much time we have. What we've started to transition people out of the hospital. So what we do is people that have kids and the child is underweight and has been consistently underweight for a long time, then we'll work with them in the hospital, but then we'll transfer them over to the women's shelter and they'll work with them there because that's kind of a setting that's more like their own home.
Right.
Because, I mean, everything's pretty easy in the hospital. There's all these nurses that are very helpful and you know what I mean? And so it's a lot easier. You don't have to do that much. But then when they go to the women's shelter, like the women's shelter encourage the mothers to feed the kids themselves, to be responsible, what they're going to eat and all the rest of it, right? This I'm talking about Fuel Your Thrive kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've had a couple of instances like that. And in this one particular instance, there was a woman here with them. There was the mum. And really, she just hung out. Didn't really do much. So to encourage her to be more involved with her child and to take more responsibility for the feeding. And there was a nanny that had come in with them and she was wonderful. And you know, she said to me a few times, and this is the way that we do it on the community. Well, it's not often that Aboriginal women share that, you know, the way that they do things when they're on their way, the way that they prefer to do things. And it worked out so well. And she came into the hospital probably after about 6 or 8 months. And she said, guess what? They're still going really well. They're still all eating. And you know what
Aww,
I mean?
How lovely.
So that was, you know, so I think that's a really good way to kind of work people to go home, you know. And I think that works, too, in terms of lots of times with their partners. Because, you know, sometimes these women are not going to go and live in Cairns or Darwin on their own. They're just not.
There's something you alluded to earlier that I just wanted to go back to, and that is staff that might be working in the hospital that might be Yolngu. How important is it to have Aboriginal people working in the hospital, particularly as, like you said before, most people don't have English as a first language? In terms of education and communication, I would imagine that'd be very important.
Well, it is very important, but it's also really difficult because, again, they have their own worldview of things, right?
Yes.
So I know that we had a woman who's actually passed on now, but she used to come to the hospital and she used to work here from 8 until 12 every day and, you know, 5 days a week. And she said when she started, she said to the manager, because I was there as well, she said, you know, I really think you need to hire 2 people. Because I'm not going to be able to be here all the time and I need a backup. Isn't it funny? I mean, I thought, what a good idea. But it just shows how different people think. And he was insulted to think that she would suggest to him how he should do his job, you know.
Right.
But she was right. She had other commitments where she used to go to a meeting in Darwin where she would work with people through the correction system. And mm-hmm. she had that regular commitment, right? So every so often she'd just be gone. And then he'd say, well, why isn't she at work today? And I'd say, well, remember, she has that other commitment, because he knew that when he hired her. But do you think he wouldn't on principle? He just wouldn't hire anybody else. So it's really important that they have that. And the other thing is, too, that you have to watch. You know, we have such things in Yule New Mathis Society as poison cousins. So you have to make sure, like if they say, look, I can't sit next to so-and-so or I can't talk to so-and-so, you have to be really respectful. But lots of times people that come into the community and don't really have any cultural understanding, they say, I told you to go and sit there, go sit, you know what I mean? And they don't realize, you know, what the implications are.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult sometimes. And I think the funniest thing, one of the funniest things I saw is there's a fellow, there was a doctor, he wrote up this 7 or 8 page info for people that were coming to live in this area. And he talked in a really kind of laid back, relaxed kind of way about ways to deal with Yule New people. And I think one of the funniest things that I heard is that there were a couple of elderly women walking along with a nurse and a doctor, and it was just after payday. And so one of the elders said to both of them, I guess, didn't you just get paid recently? And they said, yeah. And he said, oh, well, I don't think the paid that one nurse, and I guess they knew her name, but I mean, I don't know who it was. And they said, oh, yeah, she got paid. And they said, well, isn't that funny? Part of her skirt's missing, you know. So really what they were implying is that the way that she was dressed was too revealing, right? And not appropriate dress. But I just thought it was really a cute way of not being offensive about it, but getting across the message that, you know what, that's a little too skimpy for the community, right? Because those older women are very definite about what's appropriate dress. The thing that's difficult is they're not going to tell you. And if you know the rules yourself and you pretty well respect them, you can only say to somebody once. Like, you can't say, look, we're going to fire you because the skirts you wear to work are too short. It's just that it does affect them, makes a difference to them. So those things, like those subtle things, I think are difficult.
Yes. So can you point to, I guess, some resources that you found really helpful in when you first arrived here and were trying to get the lay of the land? What might be some resources that people could hook into if they're thinking of working in remote areas?
Well, I would say probably ARDS has got some really good resources. And you know what ARDS is, don't you?
Yes. So we'll put the details in the show notes for people if they want to find out more information about ARDS. Yep.
There's one book that's really good. It's called Nona and Me. It was written by somebody that lived on the Yirrkala community for about 2 years. And I think what's really interesting about the book is it shows the kind of conflict that goes on a regular basis between the Yule New community out at Yirrkala, and it talks mostly about a white girl who has actually lived on one of the outstations with her mother and father, and then has moved into living in Nhulunbuy, and the kind of conflicts that she faces, because there's always this, oh yeah, you hang out with those Abel kids, you know? I mean, it's just all the subtleties of what it's like, you know. It's difficult enough to be a teenager as it is, but it just highlights all these things that, there's just these subtle differences, but it's very difficult to kind of maintain your own sense of self and when you're really caught in the middle. And there, you know, like there are another couple of things that I've used. My mind's gone totally blank as well, but that's a really good one. And I know that often people use Sally. She's from WA. She grew up thinking that she was an Indian from India. And then found out, I think when she was in her 20s or 30s, that she was actually an Aboriginal woman. She didn't know.
Right, yep.
Because she was, and you know, I mean, that's kind of happened for a long time. The other thing that's interesting is I'm actually, I go to a book club, and I think it's part of my duty as an Aboriginal woman to kind of try and educate other women about what Aboriginal women are about, or the experiences they have, or the conflicts that they have. And so there's 10 of us in the club, and every year we get to choose one book that everybody reads. And the one that I'm choosing this time is called The Break, and her name is Katharina Vermette, I think. She won the Governor General's Award in Canada. And again, as an Aboriginal woman, you always ponder, change your mind, do all kinds of things around the issue of identity. And right. And I think everybody has to face it. I mean, I think that immigrant people that have lived half their life in another country, you know, myself included, you have to decide, you know, how you feel about things and how you treat other people who maybe are not as respectful as you are about those kinds of things. But I will do a list of books for you. Like I said, my mind has just gone blank. Right?
That'd be lovely. And we'll share your favorite books list on our podcast show notes for people to follow up with later.
Okay.
So I'm aware that, we've clocked over the hour, which is great, because it just feels like we've just had a conversation over a cup of tea and the time's just flying. Yeah. Can we finish on, I guess, what the future holds for you and, what's next in your world of work?
Well, I guess the thing for me is I really only came back this time to stay a couple of years. I thought, I'll just bump up my super and, you know, I'll move on. And I've been here 10 years this time, and I think it's been difficult at times. I think it really depends on when you're in a mining town, and the number of relationships and the number of things that you can do is limited. I think it really requires you to be, you know, what do I need to keep myself going? What do I need to keep myself happy? And, you know, it's a combination of things. I mean, I love my work, but you also have to have some things out of work that you also love as well. And I think that it's going to be very difficult for me to leave here, because I do feel very much part of the community, you know. I think, you know, my daughter says to me, Mom, are you still there? And she doesn't understand what a draw it is, because it's lovely. You get off the plane and people say, hi, Yappa. How are you, Yappa? You know, it's just a feeling you pick up, you know, and it's a comfort level with kind of not having to worry. I mean, really, it's a very safe place to live. You know, we've got an Olympic sized pool. We've got the bush to go out to. You know, you've got always got stories that other people tell you, and just really simple, a really simple life, you know. And so, but I think, you know, that I'm ready to kind of venture off, but I think I'll always come back. Yeah, one thing I want to do is I want to do a profile of Aboriginal people in this area, because I think lots of times doctors and nurses and social workers and whoever happens to work with Aboriginal people, they don't really know much about them when they come. And this is a real unique population. They don't know what kind of childhood sicknesses they have. They don't know some of the things that they go through. They don't have a good understanding of the kinship system. So I'd really like to do that kind of bird's eye view, because I think it would be really, really useful for the medical profession. We get specialists that come here on a regular basis. They just don't know who they're dealing with. And sometimes they're disrespectful, not intentionally, but just because they just don't understand the situation. The other thing I'd like to do is, on the same wavelength, I'd like to do more of an orientation for people that come to work at the hospital, because it takes them so long to kind of have their own experiences, that we could help them adjust so much easier if they had a lot more information than they do at this time, you know.
Right.
So I'd like to do those things, because it really interests me. And then I'm probably going to go and live in Cairns and probably do similar kinds of things there, you know. And I feel, you know, life is relationship, and relationship is life.
Well, whatever the future holds for you, you're going to have some beautiful lasting memories, that's for sure.
That's right.
Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, Lynn. Oh, we've got some real insight into, what life's like there in Nhulunbuy and the kind of work you're doing there at the hospital. And, it's been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Lucy. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk. the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.